This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Well, my first guest this week is no stranger to this program or to issues surrounding a more sustainable planet. He's Dr. Alan Arbogast, who is professor and chairman of MSU's Department of Geography, who'll give us a heads up on a renowned environmental photographer that his department is bringing to campus. Al, always good to see you.
Kirk, how's it going?
Al, before we get into this internationally known artist, Chris Jordan, and the fact that he's coming to visit, let's talk a little bit about your discipline, about geography, and the opportunities that it provides students who major in geography with respect especially to a more sustainable planet.
All right, Kirk. Well, it's always fun to be here and talk to you. Geography is one of those disciplines that people don't understand very well. Folks have a tendency to think of geography as being, you know, the capitals of states, where the rivers are, what's the tallest mountain in the world, those sorts of trivial things that we all have fun with. But it's a lot more integrative and holistic than that. As my friend Ashton Shortridge likes to say, everything happens somewhere. And what geographers are interested in is where things are, why they're there, and how they move from one place to another. And that can apply to a variety of things, from migratory birds to traffic patterns to urban sprawl to water issues, hydrology, all sorts of things. I study sand dunes along the coast of Lake Michigan, as you know, and I'm interested in where the sand comes from and how it got there.
Yeah, I was actually going to mention your interest in sand dunes and the book that's been out for about a year now. But what does this mean for students who might be exploring geography, but also who are really interested in a more sustainable planet when it comes to careers that they can go into after they graduate with geography?
Yeah, geography is a great discipline for the job market in the future. What is needed out there in businesses and private firms, environmental consulting firms, and all sorts of organizations are people who think holistically about spatial variables. By spatial variables, I'm talking about the distribution of geographical phenomena of all kinds across space and how they interact with each other. They range from organizing the campus and water pipes on the campus and where the traffic flow patterns are to sustainable agriculture in the Midwest in the face of climate change. One of the issues that might be facing us in the future is what happens to the cherry industry in Michigan if things continue to warm up. We've talked about that before. And geographers are particularly well suited for thinking about those kinds of issues because we're very good about thinking in space and time. And we understand the kinds of tools that are necessary to monitor and manage the landscape in these variables as things change.
And it's no accident that the state climatologist for the great state of Michigan is a member of your department.
Absolutely. Jeff Andreessen is a fantastic climatologist. He thinks in terms of agricultural climatology, you know, how the climate and the environment affect wine production in the state, soybeans, corn, you name it. And that's one of those things that people don't think about as being geographical in sort of the traditional way. But in fact, everything like that is inherently geographical.
So, again, when students come into your office, what can you tell them in terms of employability? I mean, are your kids really getting good jobs when they graduate right out of the chute?
Sure. We have folks that are working for the U.S. Census Bureau, OnStar, navigation system, with cars, people who work for the Department of Environmental Quality, GIS analysts for environmental consulting firms. What I tell them is that when they come out of our department, they're going to be equipped with a set of tools that allows them to talk about environmental issues and management at a variety of levels that makes them eminently employable.
And you mentioned GIS systems, and that's growing. I don't need to tell you the proliferation across all sorts of disciplines, but you have a very strong GIS component in your department.
Yeah, we have an excellent GIS program. We have several people who are working in geospatial technologies, remote sensing, mapping, cartography, geographical information science. And basically what those tools are used for primarily is to manage geographical data in space and time, to show how deforestation in the Amazon progresses over the course of time, where sand dunes move from one year to the next, all sorts of things.
Let's talk about a major event that's coming up on November the 20th. The Department of Geography is bringing in an internationally known photographer who's got a passion for sustainability.
Yeah, Chris Jordan. This is going to be a fun event for us. Our discipline, geography, has an annual Geography Awareness Week. It's in about the third week of November, typically. And in years past, we've sort of been sort of casual about that and sort of let it come to us. But now we're working really hard on promoting the discipline in the department here at the university. And Chris is coming to help us do that. He's going to be speaking about his work on Midway and sustainability and things like that. And he's specifically going to talk about how geography is related to his view of those issues and what we can do moving forward. Chris is a very cool guy. He is an environmental artist. His work spans from sort of an abstract impressionism with digital technology to some fantastic and very compelling photography. He is giving our keynote presentation for Geography Awareness Week, which is November 17th through the 24th, I believe. The bottom line is he's going to be talking at the Wharton Center, at the Passant Theater at the Wharton Center on November 20th, on Wednesday night. It's free to the public. And what Chris is going to be doing is he's going to be talking about his work and how it relates to sustainability, and specifically how geography is very important in his view of the world.
I know you've talked to him and you've Skyped with him a couple times, but from your perspective, he's a photographic artist, essentially, which is more than just your, as you mentioned, more than just your classic photography.
Yep.
He does digital stuff
Yep.
as well. But he really gets the interrelationship between his art and the importance of geography.
Yeah, he really does. I mean, for example, I became aware of him and his work as a result of his sort of photographical essay on Midway Island in the Central Pacific. If you're not familiar with that, albatross use Midway as a nesting place. And it so happens, you know, they feed in the ocean and the surrounding waters. And unfortunately, in the last 20, 30 years, and probably a little bit before that, they've been feeding their young plastic that's floating in the ocean. And Chris's work has brought attention to that in a very compelling way. If you go to his website, you can see those images, and
I've looked at those images, and it's more than compelling.
It's tragic. I mean, quite frankly, it's distressing, and it's very geographical because there's a feature in the North Pacific called the North Pacific Gyre, which is basically a giant whirlpool if you want to look at it that way, and the ocean is sort of circulating in place there, and plastic has a tendency to collect. Now, the estimates are that unbelievably, every square mile of ocean on Earth has 47,000 pieces of plastic floating in it. Now, most of those are very, very small, of course, but the adults, the parents of these birds, the chicks, are nabbing that plastic in the ocean. They think it's food. They take it back to their young. They feed it to them, and then, of course, they die. And the carcasses of these birds, I mean, I know this is kind of grim, but they're just filled with plastic from bottle caps to lighters and things like that. And it's all very geographical. And that's not all he's done. He's also doing some work with digital technology, looking at consumption patterns in the United States. And, for example, how many plastic cigarette lighters we go through every day as a country. How many cell phones are discarded every country within the country. And what he does is he uses those numbers, like let's say 40 or 50,000 cell phones every 6 hours or something like that. I don't know what the numbers are. But then he takes all those cell phones and he makes sort of an abstract piece of art out of it, which you can see online. And so he's trying to bring attention to consumption, sustainability, what it means for the environment in the future. And what he's going to do for us, which he's very enthusiastic about doing, is talking about the relevance of geography to these issues.
You mentioned some of his images. One that struck me, he took an image of a nuclear cloud, and he digitized that into several million of those clouds.
Yep.
And then as you zoom back from that, it shows the Titanic going down.
Yeah.
It's that kind of creativity that he brings. And he's kind of the go-to guy when it comes to green photographic art around the world.
Yeah, he really seems to be. He has a very high profile in the environmental movement. They are the kinds of issues that we should be thinking about on some level.
So tell us just a little bit more about Geography Awareness Week as well. It's something that you said you guys have been doing for a long time, but you're really ramping up now.
Yeah, we're really ramping up now. Geography is one of those disciplines, like we talked about last time I was here, that people don't understand very well. They take it for granted. It's not well taught in the high school level. We're trying to ramp things up within our department because we feel like we have a central role in work that's environmentally oriented, issues with respect to human sustainability and whatnot. And Geography Awareness Week is a place for us to talk about those issues. In years past, we've had kind of low-level events like our students will go paint a map on a playground someplace. But this year, we're really taking it up and we're going to make a campus-wide event for Chris to focus on.
Well, last year, Al, you and the department featured Chasing Ice, the award-winning documentary, which and the crowds you drew are outstanding. The Passant Theater presentation that Chris will do is 7 o'clock again, and that's on November the 20th. Is it free?
It is free. It's open to the public. We don't know how many people are going to be there. We didn't know how many people were going to be there for Ice last year, but as you said, we overflowed. It worked out, and you know, we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants here, but we think it's going to be a great thing.
And what do you make of that fact, just the Chasing Ice example, there were so many students. I mean, you ended up using two entire lecture halls at Wells Hall, but is there a growing awareness among students of the importance of this, not just geography students, but undergraduates in general?
I think so. I mean, there's a consciousness there about what's going on with respect to the environment and consumption and those kinds of things. Students are sort of plugged into that. You know, it's not in a radical kind of way or anything like that. It's just simply, you know, bringing attention to these issues and how we live in a sustainable world moving forward. If you look at some of the numbers with respect to population in the future and you know, what's happening to the rainforest, which can't be denied, and climate change and those kinds of things, then, you know, I talk in my own classes about, well, what's it going to be like for you when you're 50 years old to these kids? And I think that resonates. So the ice thing, we had no idea how many people were going to show at that deal. As you know, I mean, as you said, you know, it overflowed. And that suggests to me that there's a lot of interest in those kinds of issues.
Well, on that note, I've been talking with Dr. Alan Arbogast. He's professor and chairman of the MSU Department of Geography. Again, Chris Jordan will be coming to campus 7 o'clock, November the 20th, at the Passant Theater in the Wharton Center. Al, thanks again for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Pleasure, Kirk.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, next Wednesday on November the 20th, the MSU Department of Geography is hosting internationally acclaimed artist Chris Jordan, who will be showing slides from several bodies of work that depict, among other environmental issues, the terrible environmental consequences of mass consumption and waste. Chris, I look forward to your visit to MSU, and it's a pleasure to have you on Greening of the Great Lakes.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Chris, a little bit for our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, but some of the underlying philosophy, your aesthetic that goes into the work that you do.
Well, I'm interested interested in trying to figure out how do we face the realities of our time. And as a photographer, it's not the easiest thing because a lot of these issues that characterize our times are invisible to us. You know, so like we read statistics about 100 million trees that get cut down every year to make the paper for junk mail, or the 30 gigatons of carbon that we emit into the atmosphere every year. Like, we read these numbers, and yet there's nowhere we can go and experience those things visually or with our senses in any kind of way. And as a photographer, I want to go there and take a picture of those things. And I'm sort of always, like, trying to figure out how in the world do I do that.
Where do you get these kinds of ideas for this sort of zoom-in, zoom-out effect?
Well, with each one of those, I'm looking for... I'm looking for a sort of deep zooming image that somehow in one way or another honors the complexity of the issue, of that particular issue. And so with the Ben Franklin piece, I mean, one of the ironies of our culture that I was trying to illustrate there is whether you stand back at a distance or whether you zoom all the way in close, what you always get to one way or another with us is money. And so you stand way back at a distance and you see Ben Franklin, his portrait on the $100 bill, and then you walk up closer and closer and closer and closer, and you see that $100 bill is made of hundreds of thousands of other $100 bills. So with that particular image, you know, I was looking for sort of the meta message that we, as a culture, you know, our God is the economy. But, you know, each one of them is different. I'm trying to look deeply into these invisible issues in our culture and find some meaning.
These numbers are not picked arbitrarily.
Yeah, well, they're, I mean, you know, each one of us, when we look around at our own personal life, all we see is the small quantities of stuff that we consume. You know, I see my own little garbage can, and I see my own little ream of printer paper, and, I fill up my car with gasoline, and it doesn't seem so bad. It's just when hundreds of millions of people all engage in these kind of everyday unconscious consumer behaviors, then it adds up to a catastrophe that nobody wanted and that nobody intended. And so that's what I'm trying to look at, is like the aggregate, the collective effect of our mass consumption and the incredibly unsettling fact that each one of us contributes to it in these little tiny increments. And there's no one person who's the bad guy we can point to and say, you know, those are the guys who are emitting all the carbon. It's each one of us, one by one, as hundreds of millions of individuals. Like, how do we bear that, and how do we deal with it, and how do we change?
My guest is the internationally acclaimed photographer Chris Jordan. Chris is based in Seattle. He'll be on the campus of Michigan State University next Wednesday, November the 20th. Actually, your presentation begins at 7 p.m. at the Passant Theater in the Wharton Center. Some of the things that you do, obviously, Chris, are, as you said, they're incremental. They're small, sometimes almost unnoticeable. But you've also done work, and I don't need to tell you this, but in the wake of Katrina, you did a series of photographs, and you've also done some things on Midway Island with respect to the albatross. So some of your work is also it's not so much symbolic, it is as apparent and kind of soul-shaking on its surface.
I'm glad that you drew a parallel between those bodies of work, because that doesn't happen very often, but it feels to me like they're very closely connected. And really, I mean, what I was looking for when I went down to New Orleans and photographed the remains of people's homes after Katrina, and also when I went to Midway Island and knelt over the bodies of tens of thousands of dead baby albatrosses whose bodies are filled with plastic, like what I'm really looking for there is a reflection of our internal landscape. And there's a kind of devastation, I think, in our collective cultural landscape. And what could be more symbolic than going to one of the most remote places on planet Earth, this island in the very middle of the Pacific Ocean, thousands of miles from the nearest continent in every direction, and finding these birds who, at their heart, like in their bellies, are filled with the same substance that that just sort of permeates our culture to the very core, and that is plastic.
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time looking at those images on the Midway series of photographs, Chris, and I got to tell you, I mean, there's an intellectual response that comes later, but the initial response for me was very emotional.
I didn't make that story up. What's happening on Midway is it's a phenomenon that is astonishingly symbolic. And having gone there and knelt over those birds and looked into their stomachs, I mean, it's like the world's alarm system is ringing from this incredibly remote place. I mean, it's sending us a message. And how can we turn away from that message?
And speaking of that, if there's one thing after you talk to the students and faculty and others at Michigan State University, what would be one or two things you would hope that the students would take away, the take-home messages from your presentation?
What I really hope to impart to the people who come is a renewed connection with the deepest part of our own self. Because that, to me, is the missing piece in our culture, is we've lost contact with what we feel. And my belief is that if, on an individual level and on a collective level, if we could reconnect with the sadness that we feel for all that is being lost in our world, and if we could allow ourselves, if we could bear our feelings of anxiety and anger and fear, you know, we try to push these feelings away and always get back to a place of being happy. But I think all of these things that we think of as being negative feelings, you know, anger and shame and fear, like these feelings are natural human responses to what is happening in our world right now. And if we could connect with those feelings instead of pushing them away and express them to each other in community, then suddenly we are reconnected with the world, and reconnecting with the world is it's not inconsequential. It sort of shifts everything. You know, when we reconnect with the deep part of ourself that loves our world and that holds with reverence the miracle of our own life, then when we look out at the problems that we have, whether it's the destruction of our forests or the damage to our oceans or so on, then everything looks different. And so my belief is it's all about an internal shift. If we can collectively make an internal shift, then healing all of the external things out there would be, it would look different, and I think it would be fast and easy and fun.
And that ultimately is a message of hope. I've been talking with Chris Jordan. Chris will be on the Michigan State University campus next Wednesday, November the 20th, at the Passan Theater at the Wharton Center. Again, starts at 7 p.m. It's free to the public. For more information on Chris ahead of time, his website is chrisjordan, jordan.com, all one word. Chris, I look forward to meeting you on the 20th, and I'm sure that you're going to enjoy your time at Michigan State University.
We're looking forward to being there.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans Helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
The Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, an organization that represents more than 100 U.S. and Canadian cities, is calling attention to some very, very disturbing research. Indisputable evidence that we have a growing microplastic pollution problem in our Great Lakes. With us is David Ulrich, Executive Director of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. David, thanks for taking time to talk about this problem.
Thank you very much, Kirk.
I'll give our listeners a snapshot. What are we talking about here?
What we are talking about is a problem that we have only learned about over the last year or two. And people certainly know we've got a huge number of problems on the Great Lakes that we've been working on for some time. But the interesting thing about this one is that I am hoping we're finding it early enough that we can prevent it from getting much more serious. Basically, what has been found by Dr. Sherry Mason, a researcher out in New York, and the Five Geyers Institute out in California, is a very, very significant presence of these microplastics, generally small pieces of plastic under 5 millimeters, that are throughout the Great Lakes, but especially Lake Erie, some of the highest concentrations found everywhere. The big problem is they get into fish, and they can cause severe problems in fish, and potentially can get into drinking water and getting into humans and posing some health threats as well. So we're hoping to get on top of this problem early.
David, where do these, these microplastics, sometimes called microbeads, I think, but don't they come, and correct me if I'm wrong, from products that we use every day?
Yes. Generally, they are present in personal care products, soaps, lotions, I guess even some in some toothpaste, these exfoliants. Basically, I think they're designed to wash away dead skin or other things on our bodies that are not needed. But the problem is that they get into the wastewater that comes out of our homes, and in most instances, they're too small to be caught by the wastewater treatment plants, and as a result, get discharged out into the Great Lakes. And the beauty of the Great Lakes is that they're huge, and a lot of water stays there. One of the risks is that things like this will accumulate because the water doesn't turn over that fast. The biggest concentrations are being found outside of major municipal areas.
And these microbeads, as you said, are often used as abrasives in these cosmetic products. But your approach is kind of interesting. You've been in touch with the Environmental Protection Agency and Environment Canada about this. But you're looking at, as opposed to trying to regulate this, which may take years, you're looking at a quicker fix.
Exactly. I spent 30 years with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and I think we did a lot of good work, and EPA and Environment Canada are still doing a lot of great work. The problem is that with the types of issues that we're facing today, they arise quickly, they're new, they're constantly changing, and for the regulatory or legislative process to deal with them, it's simply too long. Everything in society and the world is changing so dramatically now. The number of things changing, the speed of change, and the magnitude of change. So what we're trying to do is really cut through all of that process and go directly to where the problem is coming from, and that is the producers of these products that include the microplastics that are being used and then getting into the waste stream. We think that this is the right thing to do. We think that the producers are going to agree with us, and in fact, a number have already agreed to phase out the product. Are the microplastics from the products. So we think that by going directly to the source of the problem that we can get a solution faster than having to go through the full regulatory process. And early indications are very positive.
My guest is David Ulrich. He's the executive director of the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. David, you mentioned, and I will mention one that was mentioned in the press account, but Procter & Gamble is one of the companies that's taking a serious look at this. And apparently there are substitutes for these microplastics that can be used, natural substitutes.
I can't remember what kind of seeds there are right now that can be broken up, but some natural seeds in fruits. And, you know, to me, this is very consistent with what I think a lot of people are trying to do, and that is getting back to, you know, more organic things. Mother Nature makes a lot of beautiful things, and why don't we take advantage of those things, use them in products, and, you know, then allow for the natural decomposition of these things. The Great Lakes can absorb things like that that will decompose over time on their own, but, you know, plastics, you know, the beauty is they last a long time, but the problem is that they last a long time. And the other thing is I understand they are absorbing some of the toxic materials that are in the lakes already and concentrating them and then passing them along to the wildlife and habitat and potentially humans. So that's the concern. So the idea here is to stop the flow. I don't know if there is any way to try to capture and gather the microplastics that are already out there. We're asking the companies to take a look at and see whether or not there might be some mechanisms, but the lakes are so large and these are really widely dispersed, so that may be a real challenge.
Now, one end of this is the cooperation from industry and the manufacturers, and you've already addressed that. What about consumers, those of us who use these products? Are there? How do we know that there are microplastics in the products, and what choices can we make when we go to the supermarket or the drugstore?
Well, this is a key part of our strategy. You know, in the first instance, we're going to the regulatory agencies to ask them what they know about it and what they're going to do about it. We've gone to the companies as well. And in each one of our 109 member cities around the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence, we're basically asking our cities to, number one, engage in some programs to educate the public about the products that do contain it. And number two, we are not calling for a boycott of these products, but we are calling on consumers to make conscious choices about what it is they use. And what they really need to look for in the products is either polyethylene or polypropylene. And I talked with someone recently who looked closely at toothpaste that they were using for their children because it was supposed to whiten their teeth more, and apparently it contained it. I don't know what the brand was. So, the print is pretty small, but you got to read the labels and look for things like that.
We've done several interviews on this show related to the plastic problem in the Pacific Ocean, referred to often as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. So there's certainly the devastating effects of that and of the Gaia out there are well documented. Frankly, I was not aware of the situation in the Great Lakes, but it's certainly understandable why all of your members are so concerned about this problem, because it could ultimately be as devastating if we don't take measures right now.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting how this one evolved, Kirk. One of our mayors, and I think it was Mayor McMullen of St. Catharines, Ontario, sent us an article about, year and a half ago. And he picked this up, and this is the beauty of the way we operate, is we've got mayors, on the ground all over the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence, and he picked up on this and said, well, this is something that we ought to look into. Frankly, we had so many things on our plate at that time that we couldn't, and then another one of the mayors brought it forward and said, hey, this is really a growing problem. Let's see what we can do to nip it in the bud. And so they asked us the staff to develop a little strategy on it, and this three-pronged approach of going to the regulators, the companies, and directly to the citizens. And we have over 16 million people in the 109 cities that are part of our organization. So we can get out to quite a large chunk of the Great Lakes relatively quickly and the St. Lawrence.
Dave, we just have a couple of moments left, but I also, I'm going to ask you this, but some of the other things that you're concerned about with the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, I would imagine invasive species and any other major issues that affect our wonderful Great Lakes.
Well, I spent all day yesterday on Asian carp. We're trying to do everything we can to make sure they don't get through the Chicago waterway system out into the Great Lakes. The nutrient phosphorus problem in Lake Erie in particular, but Saginaw Bay, Green Bay, other places is very serious. The whole range of invasive species I highlighted, Asian carp, and again, the important thing there is we're prevention. Don't let them get them in the first place, because once they're in there, you'll spend forever just trying to manage them, like we do with the sea lampreys and other things. Combined sewer overflows from municipalities, particularly with climate change, the intense rainfall events all around the Great Lakes and in Michigan as well. And we've got to solve this problem of combined sewer overflows. The legacy toxic pollutants that are in the contaminated sediments are a real danger and threat as well. So there's kind of no end to these problems, and that's why it's really important that we've got the mayors engaged. We work with the governors and premiers. We're working with the federal government, the tribes and the First Nations, and the broader public. That's what it's going to take to solve these problems.
And very impressive, with 100 U.S. and Canadian cities involved in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. David, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck with this microplastic problem as we go forward.
Thank you very much, Kirk. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, energy efficiency is always a good idea, but as we head into the winter months, what are some things that we might do to optimize our energy use and save some money in the process?
Yeah.
Well, to provide us with some very helpful tips, we welcome Brian Wheeler, who's a spokesperson for Consumers Energy. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Talk to us about energy efficiency.
Yeah, it's hardly a seasonal theme, although I feel like we should start breaking into some Christmas carols here as we're talking. But we have an energy efficiency team that's been that works year round. Obviously, it gets a little more attention because of this time of the year. But ever since the state energy law that most recently took effect at the end of 2008, energy efficiency was a part of that, and it's been a dedicated effort throughout our company. I mean, just to not to get too many numbers thrown at you, but our customers we expect to save more than $200 million this year through various energy efficiency programs, and obviously those are improvements that if you do something to your home or business, those are lasting savings. So you'll see them repeated time and again.
Yeah, I'm one of your customers, by the way, and I've followed some of your tips. I've got an electric vehicle, by the way, that you folks helped to install the charging station for. I mean, all sorts of good things. But why would a company that your major commodity is energy, and I get this question a lot, mm-hmm. why would you be encouraging people to save energy when your product is to sell energy?
Right. It does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? Well, We're a Michigan company. We cover all the Lower Peninsula. We serve people in all the Lower Peninsula counties, and we've decided and seen philosophically that our growth and our success isn't in trying to get people to simply keep the lights on all day long. Please crank up the thermostat. We don't want to encourage people to do things that are cost prohibitive or inefficient in their own lives. Our success is tied to the state's success. So, we have a lot of people who are involved in economic development efforts throughout the state, a little bit different from energy efficiency here. But the idea is that as the Michigan economy grows and more people and more customers and more activities,
there's going to be more demand.
There'll be more demand. So, yeah, let's let the demand be a positive thing as the state grows. Much as you could say, certainly, you sell more energy and make more money perhaps by every time someone cranks up the thermostat. It's not a pragmatic or a practical way of living.
And, the cost savings thing, a lot of people are thinking, I do this because it's good for the environment. We reduce our carbon footprint, a lot of good environmental reasons. But, boy, the economic reasons are pretty compelling, aren't they?
Right. And at the end of the day, I suppose as long as people get to that point where they are doing things or being thoughtful in how they consume and use energy, the reason doesn't matter so much. But, yeah, there are a lot of financial incentives. And I'll say this website now, and I'll probably repeat it a couple more times, but we have a site. It's consumersenergy.com/save, S-A-V-E, and that offers an idea of the array of rebates and incentives that are available. And so, I think mindfulness is really the important thing. As people are doing things in their house, if you're buying a new refrigerator, putting in a new furnace, I mean, a lot of big ticket things, there are some financial incentives to really help people along. I just bought a new refrigerator for my house. It costs money. There's no getting around that. But as you do,
probably Energy Star rated, right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And that's the nice thing is, I mean, if you think about where we are today compared to generations ago,
absolutely.
The baseline of where people are starting is so much better. But there are incentives there to help out, and as people are doing those sort of upgrades to their house just in the course of living, we cut a check or you find it right there at the retailer, you're getting a discount right off the bat.
I'm talking with Brian Wheeler. He's a spokesperson for Consumers Energy. Brian, as we get into the holidays specifically, people like to do a lot of lights and all. I don't need to tell you that.
Right.
What are some things folks can do specifically when it comes to the holiday season
to
conserve energy?
Yeah, and you can look at it from a few different perspectives. I mean, one that comes to mind is start more on the heating side of the coin, because that really is, that is the driver for a lot of people's bills this time of year. And you know, let's talk about a couple of just sort of practical, pragmatic things. I mean, you know, I've got a backyard deck in my house. In the summertime, if it's not too buggy, I'm happy to leave that door open and let the dogs go running in and out. Obviously, in the wintertime, you close the doors, you close the windows, you do those things. But, I mean, there are a lot of practical tips. Some of them are common sense. Some of them maybe aren't top of mind. But, you know, if you live in a house that has some drafts, you know, some windows that you know, don't seal, you know, you can feel a draft coming through, you know, caulk around the windows is obviously a great thing to do. You know, beyond that, certainly, you know, be cognizant of your thermostat, where you set it to. Generally speaking, 68 degrees. 68 degrees is thought to be a good level to set it for daytime temperature. And of course, now you see, you know, these programmable thermostats. Is it called the Nest, I believe, is the latest rage, you know, where you can monitor and set your usage, you know, really, you know, by the minute, by the hour, and do it, you know, from the house or remotely. So you can really control what's going on there. I think generally speaking, folks who would service those systems say don't tinker with your heat, your thermostat every hour. But over time, you can be mindful of that. If you have a furnace in your home, replace and clean the furnace filters.
Every year.
In fact, there's no harm in looking repeatedly, especially during the winter months when that furnace is cranking out heat constantly. And then they also say another piece of advice is setting your hot water temperature to 120 degrees. So, and you can find those tips, again, at that consumersenergy.com save site. You can find some of those ideas. You can find other ones. And those are the sort of things. You mentioned lighting.
Lighting's a big one, particularly around the holidays.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Here it is. You know, we're into November already, and I know we'll see a lot of decorations going up the next couple of weekends. And you know, I think again, when you go to retailers, you know, your major stores, you find a lot of products that are much more efficient than they used to be. That's a great starting point. Some retailers will also offer, through us, will offer discounts and rebates. So be mindful of that. You can, I won't get into all the details, but
what about LED lights?
Yeah, LED lights.
A good way to go. Some people Absolutely. Think LEDs are a little bit more expensive on the front end, but I think there are some rebates that people can get using LED lights.
Right, yeah. And as you purchase them this year, I know Home Depot is one of our major participating retailers in this, but they build the rebate right into the price. So it's
so you don't have to send.
You buy the string and there's a couple of dollars off the price right off the bat.
Beautiful.
Yeah. In a perfect world, you don't have to think about these things
too much. What about in the kitchen? There are some things, a lot of cooking going on during the holidays.
There's a lot of cooking going on.
And there are some things that people can do to conserve energy, especially in the kitchen.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of it all comes back to sort of a bit of a common sense approach in the sense that, you know, if you're baking, if you're cooking the big Thanksgiving meal, try to get as much, bang for your buck, so to speak, out of your oven. You know, if you're baking cookies, bake them all at once, make it a blitz, get the kids involved to help you out. You know, yeah, I mean, that it's a funny thing because that kitchen gets nice and toasty and the rest of the house may feel cold. But, try to be aware of what you're doing and do things at once.
You know, one thing, we've got about a minute left here, Brian, but always a good idea to start, if you really want to do a sort of a holistic approach, with an energy audit. And I think you folks are willing to, if you don't do them yourselves, you know vendors who do.
Right, exactly. Consumersenergy.com/save. I told you I'd say it multiple times. But and we do have some specific programs. There's one called Helping Neighbors. It's in certain geographical parts of the state. It's income eligible, but it has a pretty liberal threshold in the sense that a lot of people who might not think they qualify for it will. And this program in particular offers home energy audits and then a lot of things that we'll do for free right off the bat for you. And then, of course, pointing you in the right direction for other things you can do down the road. We also do have a lot of energy assistance programs. And I just want to just touch on that briefly in the sense that you know, help is available for people to set payment plans, to get rebates and credits on their bills. Again, you may not think you qualify, but maybe you do. In that case, consumersenergy.com/assistance is a way to go.
Okay, so it's consumersenergy.com/save or consumersenergy.com/assistance.
You got it.
I've been talking with Brian Wheeler. He's a spokesperson for Consumers Energy about ways that you can save energy and money during the holiday season and through the other 12 months of the year. Brian, thanks so much for being on Greening the Great Lakes.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from The Spartan Life. The key, says Stephen Covey, is not in spending time, but investing it. You are a person of value. Your quality time is limited, so it's essential that you invest most of it in people who appreciate and reciprocate. Keith Ferrazzi tells us that the only true way to get a return on a relationship investment is to give without the expectation of return. That's great advice, but it's also true that your own soul must have nourishment if it is to have the strength to make a difference in the world. So make sure your portfolio of friends has more than a few reciprocators in it. Our lives are filled with transactional relationships. We pay for something, they provide it, and that's the end of the transaction. People mumble, "Thanks for your business," and "Have a great day" after we've handed over the cash and they hand over the hamburgers, but they don't really mean it. That's not reciprocation. The places we return to, time and again, are populated with authentic souls who genuinely are interested in us, who are proactive in their interactions, who make us feel like what we do for them really means something, who reflect back the positive energy we try to share, even on the rare occasions when our own energy level is low. This is reciprocation. Reciprocation does not always mean appreciation. The best feedback is honest feedback. Sometimes that hurts. But if it comes from a place of affection, you will ultimately be glad you got it. One of my all-time most popular Monday motivators talks about the importance of de-emphasizing unfulfilling relationships and prioritizing people who care. This is a key to personal growth and chasing happiness. Treat everyone as you want to be treated, but over the long haul, don't invest in people who don't appreciate it. It's okay to give without expecting a return, but not all the time. Long-term relationships don't work if you're the only one who is doing the heavy lifting. People who don't reciprocate aren't necessarily bad people. They may have something going on inside that you don't know about. They may have other priorities, or they might just not be that into you. That's okay. If it feels like a temporary thing, hang in there. If it's a pattern, let him go. You will get some time back to spend on someone else who appreciates you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at spartanpodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.